When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, welcome back. Feels like we've never been apart. The reason that we began to do these podcasts, the big interview with me, is football gives you a shot of adrenaline and happiness and does things that you can't understand. Time and time again, it builds to climaxes that are as dramatic as anything that art, theatre, opera ever invented. One of the guys that we always aspired to talking to was Jamie Carragher. And the reason is, when you approach reporting on football for a living, you can make a choice whether you want to appear cool and always in the right, or whether you let your passion for the subject spill out at the risk of being maybe called naive or boyish. But I like to approach my work with my heart on my sleeve, open, honest, and full of a passion for the subject. That matched with Jamie, who played that way, who inspired me, who I loved watching learn and change. In this interview, he'll talk about how he rates his ability, what made him a player to lift 4 European trophies. He'll make me laugh, as I knew he would. And he'll take me back to the first time I met him, which was in a Legends game in the Olympic Stadium in Munich, just before Chelsea-Bayern Munich in the European Cup final. He was there with his boy, who's a talented footballer. And he told me about having gone, as an Everton fan, to, I think, the quarter or the semi-final of the Cup Winners' Cup with Everton when he was 8 years old, taken by his dad, because already football at 8, particularly Everton in those days, was an all-encompassing passion. We're going to go on. We're going to talk about Steven Gerrard, obviously, Alex Ferguson, Gary McAllister. We're going to talk about Istanbul. And today is the anniversary of Istanbul. Therefore, I give you one of the heroes of that night, one of the heroes of the most incredible football match you will ever see, Jamie Carragher. Jamie, welcome. Thanks for taking the time.
No problem. Thank you, Graham.
The joy of this is that I want to talk to people that I admire, people who have inspired me, but people who I suspect feel the same childlike excitement for football. You never lose that adoration of football, its eccentricities, its skill, its stories. But I want to start with a little bit of trivia. Right? I've got a scratch that I've never itched. Mm-hmm. Liverpool and Ring of Fire.
Oh, okay.
Why? I really want to know.
I broke my leg in 2003, and so on an away game, I went on a coach with my dad and friends who went on an away game for a pub in Kirby called the Fantail. And, you know, they'd go home and away every day, and they passed the time, a tape would go in, and there was fans of Johnny Cash, and they used to sing it on the coach. And then that's where I first heard it, and then it just fired itself coming into the stadium and in the ground on that Champions League run 2005. And I think it may have been Leverkusen away. I think we're the first time it sort of originated. And my dad and a few others try and take the credit, I think. He used to go on that coach, the Fantail coach from Kirby. But that's the first time I heard it. I didn't know, it was just the lads on the coach liked it, but how it got sort of to be this theme tune that you associate now with 2005 and a song that still gets sung now, especially on away games or they play it before the game at Anfield, just went from there, Johnny Cash. So I think the credit should go to the lads on that bus from Kirby.
But you'll never, none of us, will ever be able to hear that again without the hair in the back of your neck stand up. It will just transport you back to, I think, maybe you and Stevie with your arms on each other in front of a camera with scars wrapped and the cup's been lifted. It's iconic. It's like a where were you moment when you hear that song. I can't listen to it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that picture they've got, that's, I think, the iconic picture for both of us. Kissing the European Cup, singing along to that. And it's not even the words, it's without the words, you just sing along to the tune. And I think we'd have moments like that when something special happens, like Istanbul. There's lots of quirky things that people will remember on the journey. It's not just the games, there's loads of little things. And I think that was part of it. You know, the song, that was part of it. I mean, in the past, clubs have had the FA Cup final, they sing a song, don't they? Or something that gets linked with it. That was, but that was the one and only Johnny Cash.
You've reminded me, I didn't think, but we all go in the cup. What impact does music, or the right music, or atmospheric or unifying music, what impact does it have on a mood, a squad, a dressing room? I ask you that because there was a stage in 2008-09 when, for some reason, Pep Guardiola insisted that they played Coldplay, Viva La Vida, or
whatever.
And it caught like Ring of Fire. And even the players who didn't like it, it then became not just a superstition, it was something that unified. And they put it on in Rome, and I don't know how they'd arranged it, and it's booming out over the speakers in Rome, and they've just beaten Manchester United, whatever. And it felt more than just like, oh, there's a song that we all know it. What does the right music do in a dressing room or in a season? Or
Well, the music in a dressing room, I was, even though I was a senior professional, they say they normally sort the music out, but music for me, I never sorted that out. But what I do remember, even as a kid, I was an Everton fan. I can remember the songs I sang as an Everton fan in the mid-80s. I remember then sort of watching Liverpool teams as I was just getting in, and the songs you used to sing, and the songs you'd associate with a certain time, like, you know, the great John Barnes. You think of the Anfield Rap, you think of, you know, John Barnes and the World in Motion. As a kid, I still think of the songs. The other day, I think Everton's FA Cup song was Here We Go. I always remember, at the time, Everton and Liverpool wanted to win the league one year, and the song Everton used to always, hand it over, Liverpool. So you'd be like, so as much as the football, you remember those sort of, I remember football being on the terraces songs rather than being in the dressing room, if I'm being honest. I was never a massive music fan about that band or that artist.
Yeah.
It was more the songs I sort of sang on the terrace.
You see, I know you grew up a Blue, but when you grew up at a distance, and I grew up in the 60s, the thing that you taught was that singing from the cop was witty. Mm. A pop song would come, they'd take it, they'd adapt it, or they'd have their own songs, and there was real wit. Now, I don't want to go down the negative route, because one of the things that soured football is what modern kids sing to abuse people. But there used to be football, music, singing and wit used to be absolutely knitted in, particularly in your city.
I think Liverpool fans, especially with the cop, and I think Where You Never Walk Alone come from, I think it was, if I think of them right, in the 50s and 60s, used to basically play the top 10 in the charts or the top 20 before the game, and I think they maybe picked up on that song. I think that a famous one, I think they sang to, I think Gary Sprake, was it? Careless Hands, was it?
Leeds keeper. Did he throw one in? Yeah, well, maybe cost him the title. Or?
Yeah, exactly. Things like that. So, I mean, fortunate that the city you're from, you have that. So that was, I think, a famous one that we feared in the past.
So, Istanbul, 10 years. Mm. Can't believe it. But you won the European Cup. You did what Liverpool players are supposed to do. You know, it was a fantastic thing. And I went back, and before we chatted, I looked, and you won 4 European trophies, 11 senior trophies at Liverpool, and a youth FA Cup as well, which is a really, really big trophy haul. Yet, I won't swear, but you lived in a time of Alex Ferguson. You had to go up against him when his single motive to begin with was to knock Liverpool off its effing perch and to make Manchester United great. Do you look back and think that he was a curse in my playing life? Have you found respect for him subsequent to your career? Could that have been 22 trophies or 25 trophies if not for him?
I've got massive respect for Ferguson. I actually look at my career and think of the trophies that we won. Every player, no matter what he's won, will always say he wants more, and I'm no different. I still think, did I do enough? Could I have done more? I should have done more. I should have done this, should have done that. But not even Ferguson. That's one of the greatest managers of all time. The greatest Manchester United manager there's ever been. I think that's right, even just surpassing to Matt Busby. But we were up against Mourinho, one of the best managers of all time. Arsene Wenger, one of the best managers of all time, especially in our game, in the British game. If you're thinking, well, certainly the top 10, if you're talking about the top 5 or 6 maybe managers to ever manage in our country, those three names have got a great shout of being in there. That's what we were up against at that time. So to actually look at what we come out with and what we won, trophies we won, considering the competition at that time, I think I'm not lucky but sort of proud of what we did considering the competition. But in terms of Ferguson, no, I mean, I always got on brilliantly well with Alex Ferguson. I didn't know him that well, I must say. 2 or 3 times we had words in tunnels at half time, at the end of a game, both passionate about your team. But he wrote me a nice letter when I finished. So I got his address off Michael Owen and returned the favour, you know, wrote him a letter back. And I actually asked, could I meet him, is probably the wrong way, but sort of have a, what we're doing now, have a football chat. Have a meal. Because,
yeah,
listen, you're rivals, but any Liverpool fan or supporter who doesn't have respect for what he did and all his knowledge of football, that's just stupid. So, and he only lives half an hour down the road, isn't he? Imagine like he's at the end of the world. So I went and met him and had a couple of hours with him, had a meal with him, talking football, my experience at Liverpool, his Man United teams, how it started off, talking about players now, then. And the one thing I took from it is memories. I mean, my memory's pretty good about football, remembering games when I was a kid and games when I played. But I mentioned the game to him. I mean, I was an Everton fan as a kid, and I mentioned the game to him in 1987. I went to Old Trafford, and Everton won the league that year, 87. I think the game finished 0-0. And I don't know how it come up in conversation, but he told me a story about the game. I'm thinking, that's how long ago was that? He knew what system they played. He played 3 at the back. He had to pop up one of his players, and it was Graham Hogg, that he'd give the formation away in the paper the day before. And, you know, all that. I'm thinking, to remember that, the games he's been involved in, especially, no disrespect, that is not an ageism slant on him, but the games he's been involved in, how old he was, to instantly know what had gone on a little bit in that game, I just thought it was fascinating. I know I don't look back at him and think, listen, who knows? I think I was fortunate to have Gerard Houllier, Rafa Benitez, Kenny Dalglish,
yes,
Roy Evans. So I think, you know, whoever your manager is, but there's no doubt he had a massive impact on the sort of situation with Liverpool and Manchester United.
As I've listened to you, I don't know you very well, but in the times we've spoken, it's matched with what I saw when I watched you play. A fantastic ability to read the game, to inspire, to lead, to give the maximum that you had on any given day or any given season. And remember, I grew up in Aberdeen, so he did for my club and my life what he then went on to do for... And it always struck me that you're one of the players. I know he wanted to sign Pepe Reina. He was very keen on Pepe Reina. One stage, didn't happen, whatever. You're one of the players I've always thought not only he'd have chosen if he could, but I suspect you'd have blossomed under that kind of, you know, leader-captain relationship. Never happened, never going to happen. But it's the type of thing that...
Well, he'd have to manage Liverpool. I wouldn't be playing for Man United, I'm sure you know that.
I thought it must have been strange to watch him doing all those things and you think, geez, that's what we should have been doing here. You know, you had great managers, but he almost gutted the club and built the whole thing, standards right everywhere. And that's maybe one of the things that I took from rereading your book, that you lived in at a time when you were, you know, you were blessed to have played with some exceptional footballers, and, you know, the impact of Houllier to Bingham with, and then Rafa, and winning in Europe. Fantastic, but that comparison in overall standards, where things weren't maybe done correctly or the right attitude wasn't shown right around the club, that was a curse that you had to live with in your career at Liverpool.
Yeah, I love football and I always look at other managers and the managers I mentioned before. I'd love to have played under Ferguson, Mourinho, Wenger, these great managers. You look at Pep Guardiola, people sort of ask you what managers were like, different ones, strengths and weaknesses. Of course, they all have that, but I never, even when a manager's didn't quite work out for Liverpool or it didn't go as well as we would have liked, I never said, oh, he was doing that wrong. I always took something from them. They're not idiots, these people. Every manager, I'd always take the good bits from it. People would say, oh, you take away the bad bits. They always learn something. There's always something they take different from the last fella, or they saw something differently, or, you know, different things. I was a sponge with managers. And
why?
Taking things.
Why did you have your mindset like that?
To be honest, the club I was at, I mean, you see other clubs around the world and they talk about, you know, players being maybe more powerful than a manager. You see that maybe in foreign clubs, maybe the big Spanish giants. But at Liverpool, the respect for the manager is probably bigger than maybe any other club in the world in terms of players and fans. But when Liverpool win, the fans, it's the manager. I think it starts with Shankly. It was, okay, they've had great players, but the fans, it's always the respect for the manager at Liverpool, I think, is as big as anywhere. It's always flags of the managers on the cop. you know, Shanks and the ones who won the European Cup, there's that flag, and there's great players who played in those teams, and maybe at other clubs it's about the player who won us the Europe. Whereas I think at Liverpool, it's the manager. So there was, I always think the manager's 20, 30 years older than me, he's got more experience. I've never been a manager. I've never ever questioned a manager or said, why are we doing this in training, or why are we doing that? Or, and I think it was funny. I think Benitez maybe was used to maybe players questioning him, maybe a Valencia and different things. And when he first come, he sort of not laughed at us, but a bit, everything he'd say, we just do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he said, I think in a training session, he sort of, we didn't know what he was doing, but it was a bit of a test. It might have been a day before the game. And he said, I want you to do this many runs. And we just did it. Halfway through, I think he said, no, why have you let me do that? A player abroad would say, but why would we do it? Whereas, I think the English mentality, or my mentality, is just, the manager says you do that, you're doing it.
It's a soldier's mentality.
Yeah, yeah.
We're a warlike people.
Yeah.
And if your captain or your sergeant major says do something, we do it.
Mm.
I think that's in our genes.
Yeah, exactly.
I honestly do. When he said that, he said, all right, lads, stop the exercise. The point wasn't to get you fit. The point was to say, you know, stuff it, Rafa. When he said that to you, were you stunned? That's Rafa, bizarre.
Yeah, Rafa's the type of manager. It's all about football for him, is the brain, and that suited me down to the ground. I mean, even though I was aggressive and I wasn't the biggest, I wasn't the strongest, I wasn't the quickest, my game was about being alive upstairs and reading things and situations, so I love working with him. The point he was trying to make is it was a way of him sort of saying, you know, use your brain, think about what would, you know, that type of thing. But it is the English mentality. And even at times in those big games under Rafa, you think of Istanbul, you think of Cardiff 12 months later. We never won that by sort of being clever. That was hard. Really, that was everything against what he's about. But those type of games, at times the emotion takes over, especially with Liverpool, the supporters, maybe myself and Stevie, you do get too emotional at times. And those games certainly were played with heart, and not certainly how Rafa would have liked to have won them, but we didn't in the end.
A win's a win, and I wanted to go back to that as well, because I was born in Britain and I grew up, as I said, watching Alex Ferguson teams who did that mix you're talking about, which for Aberdeen it was about skill and tactics and brightness, but it was also always about heart. And when I kicked the ball at any level, it was about winning, and any old how, really. And I moved to Spain to try and adapt and learn and grow up and see different things and teach myself. That was the principal reason. Training sessions, as a journalist, training sessions were open. That was about the dominant reason for me moving over there, because I thought, I can watch training, I'll write better. And then, you know, I look at that Istanbul triumph, and I look at one of the abiding British things was winning in adversity, winning from 3-0 down. But the thing I wanted to ask you about and focus on was winning when your muscles won't work anymore. Because it's equally iconic, apart from your brilliant tackles, which I think were on Thomason and Shevchenko and whatever, there's a point which anybody who hasn't suffered cramp doesn't know that all this chat about childbirth is rubbish. Cramp's a problem. You couldn't move at a certain stage. You looked like you were going up Everest without air. How did you get through it, and what was going on in your mind to dominate the situation?
I wasn't even thinking about the cramp. My main thing was to get back on the pitch as soon as possible. When you're in that sort of zone, people at the crowd, it's like it's not there. It's playing the Champions League final for Liverpool. It's like you'd do anything not to sort of scupper the I needed to get back onto that pitch to make it 11v11. The longer it's 10v11, they got an advantage of something. My first thought was, okay, stretch off. But there was never any thought that I would come off the pitch, or I never went onto the pitch worrying, is the cramp going to come back? It wasn't. You're just in a zone, I think, at that moment in a game of that magnitude. It's just I need to get back on, I need to get back to my position. You know, we're playing a back three now, I need to get back to right centre-back.
Have you played physically more tired than that?
The cramp was worse 12 months later in Cardiff against West Ham. We'd had a longer season. The day at Cardiff that day was so hot. And it wasn't just me that day, that was players on both teams all over the pitch. That was where I was feeling it a week later when I joined up with England for the World Cup. When you were training, it still didn't feel right. But when you play centre-back, you don't normally get cramp. It's not the position that you do that much running, to be honest. But nowhere in that game, a lot of it, I think, was stretching, clearing balls. The cramp was in my groin. Normally, you'll get cramp in your calf through running. This was more, I think, stretching, trying to cut out crosses. Your focus is when you need to get back on this pitch. It's a mentality thing.
Were you talking? Can you remember if you were talking to the players around you while you were playing?
After I'd come back on?
Yeah.
I will have been. Oh, no doubt, yeah.
Can you picture it?
I can't, but I can't remember me going 10 seconds without saying a word on a football pitch without
in general,
organising or shouting at someone or geeing someone up. Yeah, I'd have been in there.
at 3-3, can you remember what you were worried about, that what Milan had?
Yeah, about them scoring another goal. It's strange, the mentality of football. You go from 3-1, 3-2, and you think, we've got to get a goal. As soon as you go 3-3, something comes, you think, oh, we've got something to lose now. You have that mentality. It's like when a team are winning 2-0 at half-time. Why did the other team always come back into the game or put you under pressure? It just happens. It's just the way it was. But I think what we put into those 6 minutes or the start of the second half, I think eventually sort of took its toll on us. And we were playing against a team who were far better than us. Far better than us. And then they changed it round a bit. Rafa had to change it round a bit. Serginho came on the left. Because we had Smicer, who was a number 10, if you like, playing right wing back. That's how the team had to be set up second half. Stevie went there then. So I think certainly in extra time we were thinking penalties. If we get to penalties, we've won the lottery. You know, we've come back from 3-0 down, we're 3-3, we're hanging on against the best side in Europe, and it took everything. We had me making tackles, Jersey making unbelievable saves, Shevchenko missing an absolute sitter. But no, towards the end there, it was get to extra time penalties.
Before we started the tape, I told you that one of my favourite Monday Night Football discussions was you and Gary, September 2013, talking about David Luiz. Chelsea have just lost to Everton. Mm. And there's a really good philosophical debate about what should a defender in the Premier League do? Should he defend? Can he come forward? Names like Baresi and Piqué are mentioned. It's a right good debate. Mm. But you're quite staunch about defenders defend. Mm. And defenders, you know, you shouldn't be one-on-one or going on a run or whatever. When the penalty was called in Istanbul, where were you on the pitch?
I was on the edge of the box. I was in the box.
You were?
I was a right centre-back stepping out with the ball, football and centre-back.
Stepping out or driving right to the opposition box and sending off a nice little ball to Milan Baros, no?
Yeah. That's in a back three, stepping
what
out.
Happened?
So slightly different. But yeah, I think I played the ball into something. Did they get 1-2? I think I played the ball, stepped out and played, and did Baros flick it round the corner for Stevie?
Yeah. You play the ball from about 8 metres outside the penalty box, right in the Baros' feet, who lays it off to Stevie.
Yeah.
Before the tackle's gone in, there's a hand
and it's yours. I'm trying to get someone sent off, I think.
What possessed you?
I think, as I've knocked it into Baros, you know what, I think a lot of you're playing then, as I said before, on emotion. I'm not saying it was the wrong thing to do, stepping in. But the way we were playing, it was just like, so we're 3-2. So this is for the penalty, make it 3-3. So what I'm saying is, in them 2 minutes, everyone's just like, right, give me the ball. You bash it in, you're actually looking for the ball. I think I'm looking for the ball back off Baros. That's why I carry on my run. And I go one way and Stevie goes the other. And he flicks it around the corner to Steve. So I think I just carry on my momentum.
You'd have hit it.
Oh,
if he'd laid it.
Yeah.
Top right or top left?
It'd still be going where the Serginho's penalty went, I think, in the shootout. But I think you get caught up again with the emotion, the crowd. I'm not saying it was the wrong thing to do, but more often than not, it's not something I would have done.
But it's something you used to do as a kid. You know, you'd eight on your back at school, you played striker, then you played creative midfield. Mm. You were digging into something that you knew you had.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think every footballer, whatever he plays, will always play centre forward or centre midfield when he's a kid, you know, for his school team, Sunday team. So it's nice for that to come back in the middle of a European Cup final, those memories.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It reminded me that I had one like glorious interview with Gary Mack about the Alaves game, how chaotic and fun that was, and what a fantastic team you had. You were equally knackered in that one, weren't you, for a different reason altogether?
Yeah. I think we were gone physically and mentally in that game, and we'd played Arsenal 3 days before and won a cup final from nowhere. The heat was unbelievable that day at Cardiff again. We'd won it late on. And I always remember going to the UEFA Cup final on the coach. And normally a cup final, there's a bit of nerves, there's a bit of tension on the bus. And I remember looking round, and it was like we were playing a normal game. Not that we weren't. We were just physically... Even being in, like, the zone doesn't take a lot, but it's like everyone was just like, we were shattered. Played every cup game we could possibly play. We won the three cups. We ended up getting to the Champions League, which we did 3 days later, and we were awful. We beat Charlton away 4-0 the first half, which could have been 4-0 down. We were that. But Alaves, on a normal day, we'd have beat them 3-4-0. And I always remember the celebration afterwards with the Alaves game. And I always remember it was like the bath at the end of the game. It was more like a swimming pool. It wasn't a bath. And everyone was just sitting there without saying it. We just won the UEFA Cup. Everyone was just sat there. It was like... It was so strange. I can picture it now because I thought, this is so strange. But I was part of it. You're just physically gone, physically and mentally gone. Like, you couldn't even celebrate. You just won one of the most, probably the most amazing UEFA Cup final of all time. We've got the three trophies, the treble of the three cups. And we had a game 3 days later against Charlton. But I don't mean celebrate in terms of, you know, getting on the aisle or something when you went back to the hotel. But even just, you see pictures, don't you? People laughing and joking in the bath, throwing a trophy around, or, you know, old-fashioned pictures, whereas we were just absolutely shattered.
This is the joy of doing this, because I've never heard anybody say that before, but you've immediately made me think, by sheer fluke, I was invited into the World Cup winning dressing room, and I came out telling friends, I've seen our pub teams or Sunday lunchtime teams celebrating an away win against Duffers with more passion than the Spanish boys. A quick hooray, the Queen coming in, Rafa Nadal in tears, painted face, the lads posing with a cup, and then whew, like that, flat, not flat unhappy, but like you said, no adrenaline, no leaping about.
I think what happens is you have a lot of you celebrating on the pitch, what happens when you win a trophy, so I think sometimes that takes it out of you, but you feel like you've done it. But certainly with that Alaves one, it was different to the others. You'd still, I can't remember getting pictures in the dressing room with the cup against Alaves, UEFA Cup, whereas if you win the FA Cup or the Carling Cup or the European Cup, you're still all... But that one was just like, thank God it's over.
You see, that what I was meaning by that is that, do you think that as fans, we underestimate exactly how drained and exhausted a footballer can get?
I think so. I think especially mentally, because physically, I think we probably all played football at different levels, and for us to get absolutely shattered is a different level to the man on the street or the supporter, but maybe not understanding or getting the mental tiredness, which I think is more...
Which affects your decision-making.
Yeah, of course, yeah. It's the build-up to the game. It's how you're playing well yourself. Are the team doing well? Have you made a mistake in the game? It's, we have to win. The pressure of, we're playing Alaves in the finals. Well, don't forget, we're expected to win this comfortably.
Can't lose because it's Alaves.
It's 4-4. Yeah. It's golden goal. We're a few minutes away from penalty shootout. It's, you know, it just... It does, it takes you to... And cup finals are normally the end of the season. Obviously the end of the season, so... It's that sort of build-up for sort of 9 or 10
minutes. When you're watching, though, now with analysts' eyes, do you have to be careful in what you'll say about what you've seen in a player, because you're able to factor in maybe more things about why positionally they might be wrong, or a pass has been misplaced, or they put the ball over the bar when really they should have scored? Do you have to factor that in, or if you factor that in, are you always going to sound too careful on the TV?
I think basically us on the TV, we've got to put ourselves in the position of the players, where obviously me and Gary have probably been there in different situations or scenarios, because you have so much experience of different games, big games, winning, losing. I think last year's game with Liverpool-Chelsea, we analysed the game on the Monday, where Chelsea, you know, stopped Liverpool winning the league. But it was more the fact of the second half, the effect mentally the first half had had on Liverpool's second half. So they were shooting and crossing from stupid areas. Now, more often than not, you'd pick that up if it was the middle of the season, just saying, stupid decisions, why are they doing this, why are they doing... Now, that's what we said, but you do factor in the fact it's desperation. It's not, you know, it's a mental thing. It's not something that they've been doing all season. That panic, that sort of mindset of, oh, they're already thinking of what we're going to lose type of thing, and it's like you just do irrational things on a football pitch.
It's a kind of fear.
Oh, yeah, that one was with that game. I've played in games like that, of course. That's what I'm talking about, the cup finals. With Rafa, where we played with the heart, it's a fear. How can we be getting beat to West Ham in a cup final? So, I mean, Stevie Gerrard scores the goal that makes it a 3-3, greatest goal we've ever seen in a cup final. I'm on the edge of the box. I'm the centre back. Why am I there? Do you know what I mean? Emotions take over. You find you're back to being a kid on the playground, running around. That's that's what you like as a kid. And we took her into big cup finals and won.
One of the things I know is that you're a real, maybe you always have been, but increasingly since you stopped playing, you're a real student of the game. I guess you were, but when you're leading Liverpool, when you're playing for top trophies, you focus on your working sphere. But you are a student and you learn and you go abroad, and I've seen you interviewing Xavi in Las Rosas, the Madrid training ground, and down with Xavi Alonso at Sabinerstrasse in Munich. What has been the process of stopping playing and learning more in depth about some of the continental ideas and decision-making and attitudes that aren't about the things that we grow up with, which is heart and commitment, physique and pace? I'm not saying Britain hasn't produced players of brilliance and craft. You know I'm not saying that. For example, the degree to which you admired Xavi was long-term, and it even overtook my admiration for him. How do you see a blend between the players you admire from France, Spain, Italy, and what we do naturally as British athletes, British players, British coaches?
Listen, I think if you blended the two, you'd have... It's the perfect match. You know, we talk about our passion, this and that. I think the thing I'd love to get to the bottom of, but that I can't quite put my finger on, is that I speak to foreign players, we watch the way they play. People say they're brought up differently, but we have then foreign coaches who come here who've coached these players. And then I watch Mourinho set the team up. I watch Capello. I've seen Eriksen. I've seen Benitez. I've seen Houllier. They're more British than the British managers. I had Brendan Rodgers, Roy Evans, Kenny Dalglish. Two Liverpool legends, if you like, in the boot room way. Brendan Rodgers, whose influence you could say is maybe a Spanish influence, the way he plays. Yep. They wanted me to play a lot more football than Rafa Benitez did and Gerard Houllier did. So then people always throw at us that the foreign managers or the foreign players, why do they play this and we do this and do that? But that's something I've got to get to the bottom of. I can't quite work out. Did they come here and coach us a certain way because we were a certain type? And would Rafa Benitez coach differently in Spain? Or is just they're the type of managers we got? Mourinho's maybe the best foreign manager. You can't tell me he plays tiki-taka football or... He doesn't, so that's something I... Well, what did Capello do when he got the England job? He played Heskey up front. Eriksen played Heskey up front. Houllier buys Heskey. Benitez buys Crouch. If that was a British manager, they'd get absolutely battered for that.
Then shoot me down. This is what it's always felt like living abroad for the last 14 years. You meet people of that generation, and what they've been influenced by is the same thing you and I were influenced by when we were growing up, watching, say, Liverpool, like... We both kind of grew up in a Liverpool dominant era, me older than you. And the impact that had on football thinking on the continent was absolutely gigantic. They were in a spell then of what I'm asking you now, but how do we do that? In those days in Spain, when Liverpool were dominant, 70s and 80s, the football wasn't as technical in Spain. That was growing somewhere else. That was happening as a process of how they taught youngsters. And what they wanted to emulate, now I can't speak directly for Capello, say, but Italian football and British football, I think, has probably had more in common about structure and defence and organisation, not identical. But in Spain, Liverpool had an enormous impact on people's thinking. So I'm not blown away that Rafa brought things like that to Anfield. He wanted to be part of the tradition. He wanted to write himself into that tradition, which is not a bad thing to want. But what I go back to, what I'm asking more about is, rather than the coaches, the players, because I think the players are different. My impression is that broadly, particularly Spain where I live, are producing players that are coaches on the pitch, probably more intelligent on the grass.
Yeah, I when people always say the foreign players are technically this better than us, now, as a whole, I'd say yeah, but I've been with Alonso and Steven Gerrard. Alonso's not better technically than Steven Gerrard. Now, I'm not saying it's a competition between the two, but the best English players are technically very good. I think we're lacking a lot more in the understanding of the game. Massively in England, massively. I think we've got great technical players. So people may say, why don't we keep the ball? England are good technically to keep the ball in a tournament, but I think our understanding of which pass to play. Do we keep the ball for keeping sake now to take this thing out of a game? Do we do that? As soon as a player comes into Liverpool, I can know straight away if he's got a good understanding of football. I mean, I always read books, read magazines, think about the game. I was probably different to most English players where, without my sort of understanding of the game, I wouldn't have been a player. I'd have been maybe a player lower down or whatever. my understanding of the game got me to the level I got. It wasn't me pace, wasn't me strength, wasn't me power, maybe wasn't me technical ability. It was my understanding of the game. So I always like talking football. And if you speak to Alonso, you know, they understand things. Listen to some British players. You know, Stevie Gerrard understands the game. Danny Murphy's very good understanding the game. But a lot of them wouldn't watch football, didn't speak about football. You'd come in after a big game at the weekend. When I was playing all the time, I had to be in Arsenal and United, both going for the title. If they played me, it was like you had to watch it. But you come in and some players wouldn't even know the game was on and things like that. So I think, how can you possibly learn or improve as a player yourself without... But I think that comes from maybe even being like, I loved the game as a kid. But I was always interested in, you know, what other people thought, how they saw the game. I think the big thing now is with coaches is it how you play or is it just about results? That's always a with certain coaches fall, I think, at times into two different categories. That's a debate in itself. But there's no doubt with foreign players, I think their understanding of what to do. Like I was watching the Europa League semi-final. Napoli played Dnipro midweek. And I was watching the last 20 minutes and just watching Dnipro play. So Napoli needed the goal to go through. Napoli never looked like scoring. But Dnipro just knew what to do. How to kill time, slow the game down, centre-forwards getting a free kick. That's a big thing for me, what winds me up in football when I'm analysing. I think they call it now game management. That's what the coaches call it, understanding what to do. There's no right or wrong how you play. I don't think everyone has their own style. It's about being successful at it. But understanding what to do if it's 0-0, if you're winning 2-0, if you're getting beat, if it's nearly half-time, it's the start of a game. A perfect example is one of my last years, I was playing at Chelsea away. We're 1-1, so 15 minutes to go, and we get a throw-in in our half, midway in our half, and one of our defenders is sprinting to get the ball, and I'm screaming, I'm slow down, but the understanding of not knowing that you need to, you're away at Chelsea, if you're playing bottom of the league, 1-1's not, you're away from home, 1-1's not a great result if you're away to the bottom team, so sprint and get the ball, we need to win. Away at Chelsea, 1-1's okay.
You've made me think there of a game that frustrated me. I'm a Scot, so I want Scotland to do well, but I lived in England. I reported on England as World Cup reporter, and you know, I want England team to do well. I certainly want them to be better represented. This is the world's number one football nation. I want them to play with intelligence. And I remember now the build up to 2008, which was an incredible breakthrough experience for a journalist like me, being with Spain and they win, and the qualification at Wembley, England Croatia, a draw sees England through. It goes to 2-2. And Steve McClaren's team is bombing on. He's looking for a winner because it's Wembley, we've got to win. A point puts you in the tournament. At 2-2, defend it as if your own goalmouth was full of your children. Nobody gets past me. And what happens? They score, there's a mistake, positioning and all. I'm looking at it and I think, no other nation in the world would do that. What the hell is it in our culture that we've lost it? Because 70s, 80s football, Britain wasn't like that. It was next to no foreigners. What happened?
Yeah, I mean,
where did all the football brains go?
TV.
Sitting on the backside watching it, you mean? Listen, you started this by saying I can't get to the bottom of it. I mean, I don't have a damn clue. We've produced some of the best football talents, best football brains in history. There are two or three generations growing through now who think of football as a means just to earn loads of money and have a flash car, who don't sit and talk in the dressing room about problems and resolve them through. That's one thing I've learned as well in continental football. Very often that the footballers will be as analytical as you, and there's a problem, as much as the coach will come in and sort it, they'll talk it through week after week on a training ground in the dressing room until that problem is kneaded out and they're a unit again. You're laughing at me now because I get very excited about this. That's the reason I do these podcasts, because I want to hear answers from more intelligent people than me, which is what I've got so far. Last little section, I want to question you again about something that has been a bugbear of mine and of yours at Liverpool, which is the whole idea of recruitment, how you recruit players. And there's a couple of anecdotes in your book about Stan Collymore, and they haven't researched where he wants to live and so on. And then there's all the way through players who weren't good enough to play for Liverpool who were signed, up to today with Balotelli, who hasn't worked. And then you get your club selling Luis Suarez, who's had one of the most controversial times in Britain, come to the city where I work, and he's about to win the treble, But if you took a look at recruiting that player based on his actions at Ajax, you probably shouldn't. Mm-hmm. What is recruitment of players like from the inside in your experience?
Well, in terms of a manager speaking to you about players, it's normally on international duty. Because a lot of fans, I'm sure the clubs go into a lot more detail, but you'll see someone on Match of the Day or a goal, so you think, oh, he'd do for us. It's not until you've got that place and with you every single day, travelling, what's he like as a team member, a squad member, what's he like around the place. It's not just the ability on the pitch. Craig Bellamy's a good one, similar to Suarez, where you'll hear reports of people saying, bad apple, don't go near him. But I always look at it at training and playing. Off the pitch, if someone is a bad egg or gets into trouble now again, you've got to balance out what they're giving you on the pitch. Mm. I call someone a bad egg when he doesn't train properly. He doesn't try in a game. Bellamy's a warrior every day in training. Mm. Trains, goes in the gym an hour before. Yeah, he's got a mouth on him and he'll question a manager and he'll have an outburst now and again. But if I was a coach or a manager, the thought of trying to get someone to train every day or give 100%, whereas Bellamy's interested in football. Suarez wants to train every single day, he's an animal, wants to play like his life depends on it. They're the people you want in your squad. You'd want them without the things they bring with it, of course. But I'd much rather have someone like that than someone, as you mentioned before, like Balotelli, who you're struggling to get on the pitch. You know, that's what I want, you know, warriors in your team. Now, it's easy for me to say I've never bought a player as a manager, and every manager makes mistakes in the market. I think it's probably the most difficult thing as a manager to get people in, get the right characters in. People always say, oh, we'll scout them properly, we'll speak to the manager who's had them before. This. Mm. Everyone sees things differently.
Yeah.
You know, everyone... I might have just said that about Craig Bellamy, but you might ask Graeme Souness, who's managed, and we might go, oh, no, not a chance. That's why I sometimes think in recruitment, there's that many people involved in it now. It's like, I always think you have a scout, he goes and watches a play, and he said he did this well, he did that well. But it might be different. I might even think he did that well. I might think that was wrong. Do you know what I mean?
I do know. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder. What are you originally looking for? How good is your eye? How good are your contacts?
I suppose that comes from trust. You wouldn't have someone working with you looking for players if you weren't on the same sort of wavelength. I get that. But I always think I feel like I'd have to see everything.
I read, I think it was Michael Calvin's book, that there's a guy, Barry Hunter was at Liverpool, I think, a scout.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's an anecdote about they wanted Alexis Sanchez. Mm. And they followed him for 3 days. Cafes, restaurants. What does he drink? Does he drink coffee or water or wine? Or what?
It's probably why you signed for Arsenal. You're getting followed.
So it didn't come to the perfect conclusion. Okay, point made, which only adds to the fact recruitment's not easy. But I look at that and listen to what you say about depth of understanding of a player's personality and behaviour and training and that. And I look at all the stats you get about fitness and position and possession. There's so much of a microscope on all of that. And it's kind of as if there's a little bit forgotten about how to put that kind of microscope on the guy who's going to produce you all these stats and win you the trophies and have the heart to keep fighting on or to lead. There must be a way to understand people better. Mm. Do you not think? Character.
Yeah, there is. I mean, I remember speaking to Clive Woodward a while ago about like player profiling. Mm-hmm. I remember rightly, I'm sure he got players, even though he wasn't buying them, when they come into the England squad, he profiled them sort of like you'd have to answer questions. And maybe, I don't know if a player would appreciate that or not, and you get the answer of what type of character he was. And I think he was just trying to get into football at the time, and he was saying, I can't believe profiling's not a massive part of who you sign, and does this player profile go with the one I've already got to make sort of the balance of a team? I think that's something he did with the England squad when trying to integrate new players in there. I thought that was interesting. I'd never really heard it spoken about like that before. I think a lot of managers now and coaches, you think of the money that you're spending on these players, it might be worth it. Might just get them to fill in a form.
We'll close on this theme now with just a hope, fingers crossed, a piece of mutual admiration for somebody I adore. The strangest signing in your time at Liverpool has to have been the guy who the manager 6 months before picked out in a video and said he's the weakness, and who was 35 and had played centre midfield for, I think, Leicester at the time.
Coventry, and yet
came in and just played like a genius. Gary McAllister.
Yeah.
Give me a bit of McAllister in my life, please.
I do remember the meeting, because I was playing midfield at that time under Gerard Houllier. And Gerard Houllier's meetings were very good in terms of motivating you, pumping you for the game. And I remember him said to me, "You're up against McCarron today. You're a petrol car. He's a diesel." I always remember that, you know, because of his age. What an inspired signing by the manager. I don't think anyone could really believe it at the time. I think they saw him as a father figure to sort of Stevie in terms of he mightn't play so much. He may play if, because Jamie Redknapp had a bad injury at the time. Mm. So maybe he didn't want to spend big money on someone because Jamie may come back. He got Stevie and Gerrard. So, okay, a bit of a mentor for Stevie. Simply, you know, the attacking central midfield position. But he come in and played that well. That Stevie found himself at right midfield, right back.
Because Gary.
Yeah, exactly. And playing alongside him. Obviously, the first half of the season, I think, was unfortunate with his wife's passing. So he didn't play, I think, so much in that first half of the season. But the second half of the season, the run-in. He's remembered most by Liverpool supporters for his winning goal at Goodison, the Gary Mack Derby, it's affectionately now called. And if I had to pick one moment from Derby games, that would be that. Hmm. Seeing him put that, couldn't believe he was going to shoot from there, but he kidded the keeper, Gerrard, and we scored. But along that sort of path, the amount of set pieces he scored, and he got one at Coventry, he got one at Bradford away, and also the amount of set pieces that team scored. He was brilliant at finding someone at the near post flick on. Arsenal were famous for it. But his delivery of a little dink to that near post, flick on, and getting goals from it. But I think a big blow to him towards the end of the season, the cup final.
Not playing,
yeah, against Arsenal. And I can totally understand, I probably think it was the right decision, even though he did come on and change the game. But Patrick Vieira at that time was a monster, and we needed Stevie in the middle just for that extra power and pace. But Stevie will tell you himself, he couldn't handle it that day. I mean, that's a game Steven Gerrard looks back on and thinks, big learning curve for me that. I thought I was there. Vieira showed me there's another level to go, which he eventually got, and in my opinion, I think surpassed. But in terms of Gary McAllister, he never played that game, but he was in 3 days later.
Steven, against Alaves.
Exactly. I think he was man of the match that game, didn't he?
He was, and
yeah,
he maybe put the ball.
Yeah, it was his. He got the goal or the assist, if you like.
The golden one, assist.
The golden, yeah. I think Johan Cruyff may have presented him with the Man of the Match trophy afterwards.
Not the worst moment in your life if that happens to you.
Exactly. Well, his son was playing for Alaves, wasn't he? Jordi Cruyff, yeah, Jordi, that day. Yeah. I think for Gary McAllister, I think to leave Coventry and go to Liverpool, and I think even Gordon Strachan was the manager then at Coventry, I think was saying to him, "You won't play, stay here, you play every week." But I think for him to sort of finish his career, I mean, he played for us for a while longer and then went back to Coventry. I don't know if it was player manager or just manager, but I think for him to finish he'd had a great career, but never maybe won those type of honours that he won, you know, European trophy. Scoring the winner against Barcelona, I forgot to mention that, against Pepe Reina, penalty. You know,
Have you mentioned that to Pepe in the past?
Oh, yeah, he had hair then. Yeah, oh, aye. No, but he was a young kid then.
That's at Anfield after a 0-0 at the Camp Nou. There's a wonderful picture which I've seen a lot of in the Catalan media of a young Steven Gerrard running up and screaming in Pep Guardiola's face at the end of the match. As I said,
I seen that yesterday.
No way!
Was he trying to shake hands with him or was he...
In his mouth! If that's what you want to call it, yeah.
That's a Scouse handshake,
Pep's saturnine. There's a black cloud over Pep's head.
Yeah.
Of course,
yeah.
It turns out to be his last ever UEFA game for Barcelona.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the passion in Stevie and Pep and the iconic photo.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And all thanks to Gary Mack.
Of course.
Listen, we've finished admiring somebody's talent and laughing. That seems like a good point to stop, because that's what football does. Jamie, an honour, a pleasure. As good talking to you as it was watching you play. Thank you.
Thanks, Graham. Thank you.
Magic. Football is often fuelled by laughter, dressing room laughter, training ground laughter, sometimes cruel laughter, but it was nice to end on a smile there, and Jamie's a funny man. But the image I'll take away is that comical image of, I'm not moving to United, so Fergie has to quit Old Trafford, move to Anfield and take over Liverpool in order to coach Jamie Carragher. What a partnership that would have been. He's perfectly suited to Gary Neville as a partner on Sky's Monday Night Football analysis, because there's always more questions than answers with Jamie. He's endlessly curious and not afraid to admit that he wants to learn, and also not afraid to admit, as he did in that interview, that there are things that the more you learn, the more they puzzle you. That moment where, instead of just answering my question, he's openly scratching his head and puzzling about, as much as he's learned about continental coaches, say, he's still puzzled about why they come to Britain, in the case of Ullier, Capello, Rafa Benitez, and then begin to coach in a more old-fashioned British style than the Brits do. It's not about immediately coming off this podcast, wherever you are listening to it, and saying, well, I know the answer. It's about always being unafraid to pose the questions. That's what keeps us all fresh and interested in football, and it's what eventually changes football. I hope you've enjoyed the chat. I did. A new character would be fascinating, inspirational, and it's, like before, scratched an itch. I always wanted to know why Ring of Fire. Look, there's going to be more coming up. One of the guys that we'll speak to in the future was mentioned later on in that podcast. I think you know who we mean. If you've enjoyed this, the first thing to ask you to do is to subscribe to the podcast on either iTunes or wherever you got it from. Audio Boom seems to be popular. Second of all, if you've got the time and you're inclined to do so, if you liked it, leave a comment. It's nice to know. It's good of you to feedback on Twitter, but leave a comment on the download site. It helps us keep this free. It helps us keep the content coming. If people can see that those who have listened to this have enjoyed it. And I want to say on behalf of Backpage Press, who've produced this and who came up with the brilliant idea for this, thank you. Thanks for being there. It's nice to have these chats, but it's even better to share them. Big thanks to everybody who listened, to those who produced, but above all, thank you, Jimmy Carragher. 10 years ago today. Well done, lad.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.